I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. On Saturday, thousands gathered in front of City Hall to call for justice in the death of Freddie Gray while in police custody. Many showed their support for Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby's decision to file criminal charges against the six officers involved in Gray's arrest. In this hour, we'll speak to Paige Kreuter, a former deputy state's attorney for the city, about Mosby's actions. Plus, cries for reform continue. Senator Catherine Pugh, who represents the Sandtown-Winchester neighborhood where Gray grew up, joins us in Studio A. With the next legislative session 9 months away, how will she keep attention focused on Baltimore's long-ignored communities? That's Midday after the news from NPR. It's been a week since looting and rioting devastated businesses and property in Penn North. How is the community holding up? And what's next? Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast, filling in for Dan Rodericks. We're coming to you from WYPR in Baltimore, WYPF in Frederick, WYPO in Ocean City on the Eastern Shore, and streaming online at WYPR.org. Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake yesterday lifted the 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew she had placed on the city last Monday following the looting and fires of Monday's riots. Like the conclusion of the Baltimore Police Department's internal investigation into the death of Freddie Gray, the mayor's decision to lift the curfew came a day early. The city and its residents no doubt are ready to move forward after a peaceful weekend of rallies. But with the first court appearances for the charged officers still more than 3 weeks away, according to the Washington Post, what can we expect around town as far as protests are concerned? P. Kenneth Burns, WIPR's city government reporter, has been covering this story. He joins us to discuss the news of this past weekend. Ken, welcome back to Midday.
Thank you.
So bring us up to speed. State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby announced charges against all six officers on Friday, including a second-degree murder charge for the officer who drove the police transport van. What reaction are you seeing to the charges?
A lot of people in Baltimore are happy that, quite frankly, that the officers have been charged. In fact, as soon as she announced that she would be pursuing charges, there were some bystanders in the crowd that started cheering before she read the probable cause statement. And going through the Penn North neighborhood going home Friday night, there were people out just celebrating. It feels like it was some tension has been lifted, wondering what's going to happen with these officers.
And, of course, that apparently continued over the weekend. Thousands gathered this weekend rallying at City Hall, peaceful demonstrations. And what factors, as far as you know, went into Mayor Rawlings-Blake's decision to lift the curfew?
I think it was a combination of factors. The fact that there have been several days of peaceful gatherings and peaceful protests, and also just the overall desire to move on in general. A lot of people felt that once you lift the curfew, maybe the National Guard will start to leave the city. And there were actually a couple of city council people that expressed that once the curfew is lifted and the National Guard leaves, maybe the national media could leave as well.
And, of course, Governor Hogan has now said the National Guard will start leaving. How long is that process going to take?
They started yesterday through the, I can't remember which.
72 hours.
Yeah, about 72 hours. Senator Pugh.
We're getting advice here from State Senator Catherine Pugh, who's going to join us in a few minutes. She represents Maryland's District 40.
But let me just say that the discussion to lift the curfew began on Thursday, and there were many urging that the curfew would be lifted on Friday. And the discussions began on Friday around the lifting of the curfew. And I think because the mayor recognized and many people in the business community were suffering economically. But there was some intelligence, my understanding, from the governor's office and so forth as it relates to some of the folks who were still in the city. Because as you remember, quite frankly, there were a lot of people who were from out of town who were here as well. And some people, you know, came to demonstrate peacefully with us and with the community. Some folks came to defy the curfew. And there were stragglers each night who just wanted to defy the curfew. And so I think that all those things were taken in consideration But, you know, really was concerned about, because there were those of us urging that it be lifted on Friday, because, you know, the economic impact that the business community was suffering, not just around Penn North, but, you know, the people downtown, the people uptown, the people midtown, were going to suffer was great. And when you think about the big fight this past weekend and all the bars and all of the other entities in the community who certainly would have benefited from it, and the folks who were having their parties at their homes, you know, afraid to actually venture from one place to the another because they didn't want to be caught up in the curfew, a lot of economic loss. But, you know, I tell folks, I'm not a Monday morning quarterback, but, you know, you have to leave those decisions to the people who are, in fact, in charge and hope that they're making the decision in the best interest of all of us.
Senator Pugh, I'm going to move your mic a little bit.
I just moved.
I always have
Senator
to insert
Pugh's
myself every now and then.
We're doing a little housekeeping right here on the air.
But the National Guard did start to move out of Baltimore yesterday. Well, we found that out from Baltimore County.
Yeah, in fact, the state police, I saw people from Pennsylvania police leaving town up straight up 83. The discussion began, and what has been concluded by the governor is that it will be a 72-hour period. Because what I think most folks don't understand is, because the other question was, have we lifted the state of emergency? And the only way that they get paid, the National Guard, is when a state is in emergency. And so that was one of the reasons that you had to give that some consideration, because once they pulled out, you know, there was some concern that we wouldn't have the kind of coverage that was needed in the city.
Right. Let me switch while I've got both of you to another use of that word coverage, which mm-hmm. is to say news media coverage.
Well,
is there concern? And Kenny, let me ask what you're hearing, and then I would like to hear Senator Pugh's thoughts about whether the dissipation of the National Guard being here, the curfew, things sort of returning to normal. Is there a concern by some that the focus will be moved off the problems that need to be solved?
I think people were just offended that they felt that Baltimore was misrepresented in the national media as far as.
Well, you know, yeah. I think there's it's twofold.
Yeah.
Because I think it depends on how you depicted the community. Like, I had an opportunity, and I thank the national media for giving me the opportunity to raise the conversation around police reform on a national level. And so, you know, and so I'm somewhat grateful, because not only did they shine the light on what was happening with Freddie Gray, they shined the light on these kinds of issues nationwide. And that's why you saw Cleveland, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, all coming in their cities to protest this issue. You look at what's happening over in Tel Aviv. You know, people are concerned about police who are out of order in their positions. And let me be real clear. The majority of the police in our communities know how to conduct themselves. So this is not an indictment on all police officers. You want to weed out those who don't understand how they should function in our communities. And what we have begun to do because of the national media is to elevate that conversation on. So when you talk about police reform, what are you talking about? And when I talk about police reform, I'm talking about, you know, looking at racial profiling. It's a major issue. So how do you turn those things around? What is it that when people become so scared that if they get eye contact with a police officer, they feel like they've got to run in the other direction? And then you as a police officer feel that you've got to run after that person. So the cultural diversity training that needs to take place, I think you're going to hear those conversations around the nation, because we've been able to elevate. And that's why I said to Baltimore, let's let the media see Baltimore, but let us begin the conversation around the unevenness of race relations in this country. Let's talk about the disparities that exist in the income gap and the neighborhoods that they can shine their lights on that are not redeveloped like they should be. And then show them the other parts of Baltimore. Because I actually took one of the CNN, one of the national reporters around to other parts of the city, because I wanted them to see my city. Because I said, you know, what you're seeing on North and Penn is not all Baltimore. I can take you to neighborhoods like Ashburton and Roland Park and Guilford and Bolton Hill and Reservoir Hill, and you can see community folk working together. So we were able to do that.
But at the end of the day, Senator, I mean, and I did see a couple of your interviews on national media. My concern is just what people are going to remember. And they're going to remember the protests, and they're going to remember particularly some reporters who didn't do their homework.
Well, let me just say, because I'm still getting calls from national media. You know, I was on CNN just a few minutes ago. I'll be on, whatever. Anyway, I've got interviews this evening, but the Situation Room and all those. But yes, but what it does, it begins that conversation. It helps you to have those national conversations. As Wolf Blitzer says, when you're in D.C., we need you to come in and sit in the studio and have a conversation. Television, same thing. So I think that if we spend things in the correct way, and that's why you want people who really understand the needs of Baltimore to have those conversations. And so we begin to have the conversation around race relations, diversity, the need for increase in investments in neighborhoods that have not been invested in. You can also begin the conversation about the drug treatment centers that are inundated in Baltimore, and people think that everybody in Baltimore is on drugs. And you also begin the conversation about who we are, you know, in the African-American community, who we are in the city of Baltimore. And one of the things I continue to say every time I stand before the media, the national media, you know, the African-American community is not monolithic. You know, we're a microcosm of America. You know, we have very, very poor and very, very wealthy. But the access to wealth in this country is uneven. And that's why, as a legislator, you have a responsibility, at least I feel that I do, that anytime, and you know I do, anytime a bill comes up in the General Assembly and it's talking about jump-starting industry and so forth, I raise the question, where's the MBE, WBE participation? Because every time you ask me to pass legislation that requires the taxing or fees attached to people's BG&E bills, I want to know, well, where is the ownership piece? Because I've heard folks say, well, you know, we're going to push that minimum wage bill. We're going to make sure people have sick leave and all. And those things are important. But so is the disparity and the spreading of wealth in all of our communities and the sharing. Because, you know, we take a pledge, one nation under God. And so what that means is that we all should be sharing. If we're all putting in, we all should be getting out.
That's State Senator Catherine Pugh of District 40 in West Baltimore here on Midday. I'm Sheila Cass sitting in for Dan Rodericks. And also with us is Kenny Burns, WIPR reporter. Before I let you get back to your reporting, Ken, tell me how you're going to continue to follow this story.
Well, covering many of the stories that the senator have mentioned, people recovering, people working together, because really that's the next phase on it. We've seen the ugly, but right now I think the next story is the good in the very near future, because even before we get to the trial, there's a whole bunch of legal wrangling that needs to take place as far as motions and what will be allowed and all that sort of stuff, even before we even have the opening statements in the trial that is pending.
Kenny, I wish you luck on the streets. Keep us informed. We're going to take a short break now here on Midday. I'm Sheila Cass sitting in for Dan Rodericks. Senator Pugh is going to stay with us. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 410-662-8780 or toll free at 866-661-9309, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'll be back in a bit. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast, filling in today for Dan Rodericks. And with me here in the studio is State Senator Catherine Pugh, who represents both the Sandtown-Winchester neighborhoods and the Penn North neighborhood. Senator Pugh, you mentioned the interest that businesses had in seeing the curfew lifted. What are you hearing from businesses in your district about, first of all, their reaction to the end of the curfew, but also where they see things going next?
Well, they were excited about the end of the curfew. They really were. I actually went down to the corner of North Avenue and Penn when the mayor told us that the curfew was lifted, and talked to many of the business people, and they were happy that the curfew was lifted. I think what people want now is to see where we're going. What's the next direction? And we've had conversations with a number of people, business developers, and because, you know, as I said earlier, the city can't do this by itself. The state can't do it by itself. And the federal government can't do it by itself. It really is going to take a combination of public and private partnerships investing in our uptown in Sandtown Winchester. And there have been some investments in Sandtown Winchester, and it's sporadic investment. And you can see it when you walk around Baltimore that there have been some improvement made. But, you know, it's not just the housing issue. It is the drug treatment issue. It is the economic development issues as it relates to the creation of jobs and the training dollars and the growth of businesses in those communities that will continue to provide the jobs that people need. I said just a few minutes ago when I was down in front of City Hall, and there were the historically black colleges and universities were down there in solidarity for Mr. Gray. And I said to them that I'd spent the had last night bent the president of Morgan State University's ear about how their students can be engaged in helping us to move forward, because there's an architectural school there. I said, you should take the students over to Sandtown and over to that part of the community and have them engaged in redesigning that community so that we can show developers and so forth what we want that area to look like. Because one of the things that Baltimore is missing, as I see it, are we're the senior living communities that look like the senior living communities out in other areas and other parts of our state. You know, where are the single family homes, the new developments of single family homes? And we've got some going on, but where the, you know, some, and the more supermarkets in some of the areas. And that's why people were so hurt as to what happened in Mondawmin, because Mondawmin, we put so much effort into bringing a credible supermarket in that area. We put a lot of effort in bringing the Target to that community and a number of small businesses. And so many of them were hurt. But as I walked through Target the other day when it opened, people were joyous. They were excited that we were, you know, going to make sure that economic development continued to survive in those neighborhoods. And let me just say, I want to thank Rite Aid. I want to thank the CVS because they've committed to coming back into those neighborhoods. And that's a great thing when you think about those senior buildings right next door to the CVS and so forth. Now, that one's going to take a little longer because it actually was burned out. But many of them will be opening up very shortly. So I'm pleased with that. But, you know, I told people I don't condone violence in any way. And we had some misguided people and some folks who took opportunities, took their opportunities as a result of a bad situation. And we don't want people to act out like that. And so I think that what you'll see in the future are people just working together and trying to make a better Baltimore.
That's State Senator Catherine Pugh here on Midday on WYPR. If you have a question for State Senator Pugh, this is the time to ask it. She's going to have to leave us in a few minutes. So if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I hear you talk about the need for especially investment that's going to create jobs. And I think, well, it's not like you and others have not been working already to try to create jobs. What new can be done?
Let me just say a few things. One, the Penn North area, part of that is the new part of my district. But I ride, I leave Baltimore by way of Monroe Street. I come back in by way of Fulton Street to be reminded of what we have not done, what we started and what we've not completed. Burned out church has been sitting on the corner now for at least the last 10 years that I've known, and we've not torn it down. If it was in other neighborhoods, we'd figure out how to tear that down. I think that we will shortly. But we're doing things, but I don't think that we're connecting all the dots. For example, in July 2nd, in my district, 40th district, we'll give away $250,000 in scholarships to people in our community from 18 to 80. It doesn't matter who want to change their lives. Everybody doesn't know that, you know, contacting our offices. But the investment that needs to take place in our neighborhoods, in our community, just have not come at the levels that they need to. When you look at some parts of Baltimore, you think you're in a war zone. And so we've got a lot more work to do.
Let's take a call from Anna in Baltimore. Anna, you're on the line. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you.
You have a question for Senator Pugh.
I do. I wanted to ask the senator what plan there might be in place as far as getting police more involved in the communities they work in.
Okay, thank you, Anna, for that question. Let me give you a couple answers. First, again, I would just want to make it clear that, you know, this is not an indictment on the entire police department. And you will see, according to our police commissioner, police walking the beats.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast, filling in today for Dan Rodericks. And with me here in the studio is State Senator Catherine Pugh, who represents both the Sandtown-Winchester neighborhoods and the Penn North neighborhood. Senator Pugh, you mentioned the interest that businesses had in seeing the curfew lifted. What are you hearing from businesses in your district about, first of all, their reaction to the end of the curfew, but also where they see things going next?
Well, they were excited about the end of the curfew. They really were. I actually went down to the corner of North Avenue and Penn when the mayor told us that the curfew was lifted and talked to many of the business people, and they were happy that the curfew was lifted. I think what people want to do now is to see where we're going. What's the next direction? And we've had conversations with a number of people, business developers, and because, you know, as I said earlier, the city can't do this by itself. The state can't do it by itself. And the federal government can't do it by itself. It really is going to take a combination of public and private partnerships, investing in our uptown in Sandtown, Winchester. And there have been some investments in Sandtown, Winchester, and it's sporadic investment. And you can see it when you walk around Baltimore that there have been some improvement made. But, you know, it's not just the housing issue. It is the drug treatment issue. It is the economic development issues as it relates to the creation of jobs and the training dollars and the growth of businesses in those communities that will continue to provide the jobs that people need. I said just a few minutes ago when I was down in front of City Hall, and there were the historically black colleges and universities were down there in solidarity for Mr. Gray. And I said to them that I'd spent the had last night bent the president of Morgan State University's ear about how their students can be engaged in helping us to move forward, because there's an architectural school there. I said, you should take the students over to Sandtown and over to that part of the community and have them engaged in redesigning that community so that we can show developers and so forth what we want that area to look like. Because one of the things that Baltimore is missing, as I see it, are we're the senior living communities that look like the senior living communities out in other areas and other parts of our state. You know, where are the single family homes, the new developments of single family homes? And we've got some going on, but where the, you know, and the more supermarkets in some of the areas. And that's why people were so hurt as to what happened in Mondawmin, because Mondawmin, we put so much effort into bringing a credible supermarket in that area. We put a lot of effort in bringing the Target to that community and a number of small businesses. And so many of them were hurt. But as I walked through the Target the other day when it opened, people were joyous. They were excited that we were, you know, going to make sure that economic development continued to survive in those neighborhoods. And let me just say, I want to thank Rite Aid. I want to thank the CVS because they've committed to coming back into those neighborhoods. And that's a great thing when you think about those senior buildings right next door to the CVS and so forth. Now, that one's going to take a little longer because it actually was burned out. But many of them will be opening up very shortly. So I'm pleased with that. But, you know, I told people I don't condone violence in any way. And we had some misguided people and some folks who took opportunities, took their opportunities as a result of a bad situation. And we don't want people to act out like that. And so I think that what you'll see in the future are people just working together and trying to make a better Baltimore.
That's State Senator Catherine Pugh here on Midday on WYPR. If you have a question for State Senator Pugh, this is the time to ask it. She's going to have to leave us in a few minutes. So if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I hear you talk about the need for especially investment that's going to create jobs. And I think, well, it's not like you and others have not been working already to try to create jobs. What new can be done?
Let me just say a few things. One, the Penn North area, part of that is a new part of my district. But I ride, I leave Baltimore by way of Monroe Street. I come back in by way of Fulton Street to be reminded of what we have not done, what we started and what we've not completed. Burned out church, been sitting on the corner now for at least the last 10 years that I've known, and we've not torn it down. If it was in other neighborhoods, we'd figure out how to tear that down. I think that we will shortly. But we're doing things, but I don't think that we're connecting all the dots. For example, on July 2nd, in my district, 40th District, we'll give away $250,000 in scholarships to people in our community from 18 to 80. It doesn't matter who want to change their lives. Everybody doesn't know that, you know, contacting our offices. But the investment that needs to take place in our neighborhoods and our community just have not come at the levels that they need to. When you look at some parts of Baltimore, you think you're in a war zone. And so we've got a lot more work to do.
Let's take a call from Anna in Baltimore. Anna, you're on the line. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you.
You have a question for Senator Pugh.
I do. I wanted to ask the senator what plan there might be in place as far as getting police more involved in the communities they work in.
Okay, thank you, Anna, for that question. Let me give you a couple answers. First, again, I would just want to make it clear that, you know, this is not an indictment on the entire police department. And you will see, according to our police commissioner, police walking the beats. I've walked the beat with our commissioner, walking in and out. They've got to understand the community better, and he knows that. But I believe that, you know, among the reforms that need to take place is the implementation of psychological evaluations of our police officers after they've been on the job for a number of years. Is that 3 years? Is that 5 years? I'm not sure. I think I'll leave that to the experts. And the reason I say that is because I was talking with a friend of mine who's a social worker, and she said, you know what, sometimes I get desensitized, you know, because I'm hearing the same thing over and over and over. And I think that sometimes, and this is my opinion, that some of our police officers in those kinds of positions facing the same thing on a daily basis become desensitized. I also believe that there needs to be cultural diversity training among our police officers because, as you well know, the police department is majority white. I mean, we've got 60% white, about 40% African American. So, you know, the disparity is a little different as it relates to who's serving our community. And the other thing is, I think you got to walk among the people in order to understand the community better, because there's this fear that exists out there of police officers, and especially among young black males who don't even want to be confronted in any way by the police. And so we've got to have our officers on our streets, in our communities, understanding what our communities are about, and remembering that they're there to protect and serve. And that's to protect and serve all of us, because our tax dollars is what pays for them to be on the job.
And Anna, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Do you feel like you got a question? You got an answer to your question?
I do. The thing I'm thinking about specifically really is having police officers who live within the city, working within the city. I don't know the number, but I have heard references and statistics saying that a bulk of our city police don't live in the city that they're policing. And I think that could make a huge impact on their presence in the community and on a community's reaction to their presence.
And Anna,
if they were present as neighbors as well as police.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. I'm originally from Philadelphia, and in Philadelphia, everyone who worked for the city had to live in the city, whether you were a teacher, whether you're a police officer. And I know that the city has an incentive for folks who work for the city who will live in the city. And I think there probably needs to be an evaluation as to who, how many of our police officers don't live in the city. And perhaps if we can't, and I can't imagine that we can't find enough police officers living in Baltimore or who are in Baltimore who want to be police officers. We had a program once at Walbrook for our young people in the high school, in high schools, and training them to become police officers. But I don't think the program actually took the step that led them into the police department. And we're not recruiting from our colleges and our universities either. I mean, there are people who are interested in law enforcement there. So I think you're right in terms of how do we get our community to be more represented, not just in the police department, in the fire department, and teachers in our school system, because what that does, it also helps to build our tax base.
Anna, I thank you for your call. We have just a minute left with Senator Pugh. Don in Glen Burnie, can you make a quick question?
I can't make a 1 minute, but I will say this. This has nothing to do with race. There are many, many people that are indigent, that are white, and why we aren't addressing that issue. And the other thing is to show the disrespect of a police force that have people throwing bricks and the mayor say, stand down. And because these poor people were ordered to stand down and have bricks thrown at them, let the mayor and the city council stand there and let these people throw bricks at them And I just have to say, Sheila, I'm one of your biggest fans. I think you're one of the best people ever to be on the radio.
Thank you. But let's hear from Senator Pugh to respond to your broader points.
Let me say to Don, I agree with him. I do not believe that anyone should condone folks throwing rocks and so forth at police. I walk the streets every single day from Monday until and even last night and stood with the police. In fact, was able to go behind the police lines where they let me hold their bullhorn and tell people, hey, it's time to go home. I had some great people in the community who walked up to me on the last night of the curfew and said, Senator, we're feeding the people over here. And I said, well, that's great, but can you shut it down because it's 10 o'clock? Because we don't want disruption between police officers. And this is not a black and white issue. I'm an African-American, so I feel very comfortable talking about the needs of the African-American community. But as a state senator, I represent the state of Maryland. And so I've already had conversations. I'm the majority leader of the Senate. I've had conversations with my minority leader, who actually happened to have been here as one of the guards for the city. And we've talked about what we can jointly do together, because the reality is, and I think the misperception is, that, you know, most people in the on the welfare rolls or black people are poor black and in real trouble. And again, my conversation has been that we are just a microcosm of America. We have the very, very poor and the very, very rich. And when you talk about who's on welfare in larger numbers in this country, it's not just black people. In fact, it's the white community. But at the same time, it's how we work together that we help to change the lives of all people in this country. And that's why I say one nation under God. That's what this nation is supposed to be about. And that's what I'm working towards.
Catherine Pugh, Majority Leader of the Maryland Senate, I appreciate your taking time to be with us. I know you have to leave. And keep in touch with us as this unfolds.
Real quickly, one gentleman wanted to ask about why did it take the death of Freddie Gray to bring this kind of attention. And I'm sorry that it took the death of Freddie Gray to bring this kind of attention. And that's why it's incumbent upon us to not let his death just be in vain. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Catherine Pugh. I was actually going to go to that caller as you leave us, but I don't see him still on the board. I'm not sure whether we've lost him. But let's go to Janet in Pikesville. Janet, you're on the Midday Show.
Hi. I live in a very nice senior apartment in Pikesville. It's surrounded by high-end, multifamily retail apartments. And sometimes we take bus trips and we go right down Reisterstown Road, and it's very sad to see the buildings with the roofs falling in, which is obviously either a landlord or just a building owner problem. And, other houses, other buildings, houses falling down, the walls crumbling. So, obviously, you know, the area needs development. And I was wondering, I have two questions about the development. Is it true that if you thoroughly develop a block or several blocks, it seems to me that would completely wipe out the crack problem in those blocks? And my second question is, has there been any block-by-block analysis of these neighborhoods so that they could be developed, but to prevent the type of gentrification that wipes all the residents out, so to enable people who have lived in their homes for years and tried to keep them up, to enable these people to keep their homes?
You're asking questions, Janet, that are beyond my ability to answer. I certainly think my impression is there has been a lot of analysis, whether it is the kind of block-by-block analysis that answers your question, I'm not sure, and we'll probably hear from other callers who can answer that. But I think you raised some good points, and I appreciate your calling. I'd like to put before us now some other voices from the community. On Saturday, Midday producer Connor Graham attended the rally in front of City Hall and got reactions of some of the attendees to the charges against the six officers involved in the arrest and transport of Freddie Gray. So I'd like to play some of those clips, a few of those clips of his conversations now. But we also want to invite you to share your questions and comments. So give us a call at 410-662-8780, or you can call us toll-free at 866-661-9309, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. The first clip I'd like to hear is from Henry in Roland Park. When he was asked how he felt when he first heard of the charges, he had this to say.
Well, I felt good. Where I was working, everybody got the news immediately over their Twitter accounts, I suppose. And so that became the topic of conversation. And it was sort of like people breathed a sigh of relief. But almost in the same breath, people said, well, that's just the indictment. Wait now for the trial. So I think a lot of people are expecting this to go the way of most police investigations.
Next, we hear from Ejaz. Originally, Ejaz is from New Jersey, but he's been a Baltimore citizen for the past 5 years. And he said this about the criminal justice system.
I mean, I think we need systemic reform of the criminal justice system. You know, a lot of what happened, the failures in Ferguson and the failures in Staten Island, are because prosecutors are abusing their discretion. And I think here we have Marilyn Mosby as an example of, she's not abusing her discretion, but she's using it to enforce justice equally among all races, no matter the occupation or the race. And I think more prosecutors need to do that. And I think we need reform in the criminal justice system to make sure that we're not over-policing certain neighborhoods and discriminating against certain races.
People came from across the country to be part of that rally on Saturday. One of them is Taya from Atlanta, Georgia. Taya expressed the need for change nationally, not just in Baltimore.
Well, you know, they brought charges down on the killer cops, but that doesn't necessarily guarantee a conviction. They can still let the cops off, you know, and that's what we're telling people, that don't get too excited, you know, because they always let murdering cops off whenever their people are on trial. The prosecutor always forgets how to prosecute, you know, and I think that the only reason they charged those police officers was because people came in the streets and refused to accept police murder and police terror, and that's what people have to do around the whole country to stop police violence.
Karen, a native of Baltimore who now lives in Odenton, shared a similar sentiment. Here's what she said.
First of all, we just need to wait and see what happens, because they haven't been, you know, they haven't been brought to trial yet. So the main thing for us to do is continue to stay vocal and wait and see for the process to take place to see what happens with these officers.
Claire from Baltimore County is calling us. Claire, what's on your mind?
On my mind is the intersection of race with class, and I'm concerned that it's not just racism that is in play when police brutalize someone or poor folks intersect with social services in the city, and that, you know, even African American folks who are educated and middle class and working, they are desensitized or so distant from the plight of poor folks that when they encounter them in difficult circumstances or whatever, there is an aversion or a hostility that also is informing the interactions that take place. It's one explanation I have for why there are three African Americans who are among the six who were charged with these crimes. I'm just wondering about it.
So you're saying that it sounds to me like in part you're agreeing with those who say this is not a race issue.
It's clearly a race issue. I think there's clearly race involved. But class and socioeconomic status is also playing into this.
And Claire, is it your thought that if we do successfully do a better job of creating jobs in places like Sandtown, Winchester, and Penn North, that we will begin to affect that class dichotomy?
I think, in one way, but the other is just getting folks, white and black, who are in the middle class, who have left Baltimore and we're out in the counties, who came in last week and were helping and interacting and meeting people and, you know, to be doing that kind of work on an ongoing basis through churches and nonprofit organizations and whatever. It's, you know, getting people-to-people contact and seeing people face-to-face and developing the ongoing human relationships that I think will have an impact, not just bricks and mortar and jobs and whatever. I think we need to have more class interaction in our society.
Claire, I appreciate your thoughts. I'm glad you called. We're going to take a quick break now on midday. And still ahead, Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby filed charges on Friday against those six officers. After a break, a former Baltimore prosecutor, Paige Croyder, will join us to discuss those charges, the investigation by the state's attorney's office, and what will happen next. You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Still ahead, in midday's second hour, we get a closer look at two organizations and what they hope can be achieved as a spotlight is focused on their neglected communities. James Timpson, director of Safe Street Park Heights, a gang violence intervention program, joins us, as well as the directors of a community resource effort in Penn North. That's midday after the news at 1. I'm Sheila Cass, filling in for Dan Rodericks. You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR. We're going to hear a clip now from State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby.
My team worked around the clock, 12 and 14-hour days, to canvass and interview dozens of witnesses, view numerous hours of video footage, repeatedly reviewed and listened to hours of police videotaped statements, surveyed the route, reviewed voluminous medical records, and we leveraged the information made available to us by the police department, the community, and the family of Mr. Gray. The findings of our comprehensive, thorough, and independent investigation, coupled with the medical examiner's determination that Mr. Gray's death was a homicide, which we received today, has led us to believe that we have probable cause to file criminal charges. Yes!
That was State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby at her press conference Friday when she announced that she was filing criminal charges against all six of the officers involved in the arrest and transport of Freddie Gray on April 12th. Most of the officers are charged with crimes that carry a maximum 20-year sentence, but Officer Caesar Goodson Jr. faces up to 65 years in prison, and Lieutenant Brian Rice faces up to 30 years in prison. By some, Mosby is being praised for finally speaking up for the disenfranchised, while others criticize the severity of the charges and the speed with which she filed them after conducting her office's own independent investigation. Paige Croyder is a former deputy state's attorney for Baltimore City. She worked for the office for more than 20 years, retired in 2008. She also was the former chief of the charging division, and she joins us here in the studio with thoughts on Mosby's decisions. Paige Crowder, thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
To start, is it rare that police officers are charged criminally?
Well, I don't know how one defines the word rare. It does happen. It's happened, you know, multiple times during the time that I was a prosecutor. They've been charged for planting evidence, for lying on a statement of charges, for there was a one at the beginning of Greg Bernstein's tenure where they took a minor out of the jurisdiction, left him to make his way back. I mean, there have certainly been plenty of precedent for it.
Some people have called for a special prosecutor, said a special prosecutor should have been appointed in this case. When is that option usually used?
I'm not sure that's a question that I can answer. I think that it has certainly been prompted by her ties to her husband in the sense that he's a politician, and what she might do might affect...
This is City Councilman Nick
Mosby. That's correct. What she might do...
West Baltimore.
That's right. What she might do might affect his career, her own ties to Billy Murphy, who is the attorney for the family of Freddie Gray, who was a visible and big supporter of hers in her campaign. So I think those are legitimate issues to be raised, and probably at any point she can decide... at this point, she has filed the charges. At this point, though, she could, if she wished to, recuse her office. But she's made that plan. She doesn't intend to do that.
Many people were surprised how quickly the charges were announced just one day after the police turned over their investigative findings to the state's attorney's office. What does that indicate to you?
It indicates to me that she was hasty and reckless and has left herself legitimately open to questions about her motivations and her bias, as well as even perhaps her competence.
Well, I've heard people in the community say she lays out a set of facts that seem to put together probable cause for the crime she's alleging. And if she can do that quickly, isn't that good for the community?
Well, quickly is not her mission. Accurately and dedication to the truth, however long that takes, is her mission. In 2 weeks of what is a very complicated and messy case, 2 weeks is not a sufficient time to have gathered the evidence necessary to make the judgments in this case. She, even by her own admission, didn't even receive the autopsy report until the day she announced the charges. She couldn't possibly have had the time to adequately review that. She had the police report merely one day. She relies almost entirely upon her own investigation. Well, she did not use her best resource, which was her own homicide division. The chief of that homicide division is probably maybe the most experienced homicide prosecutor in the state of Maryland, did not use him to investigate this case for her. Instead, she used what she called her police integrity unit, which on her own staffing chart doesn't even have a supervisor. She did not, obviously, spend much time with the police report, having had it only one day. And she also, almost all prosecutors would take advantage of having the grand jury available to them to help them with an investigation. The grand jury, in order to preserve the testimony, in order to examine the evidence, in order to issue subpoenas, and in order, and particularly to get feedback from ordinary citizens as to how they view this evidence. She didn't do that. As a matter of fact, she not only used the use of the grand jury, but the normal charging procedure. Normally, the police department would issue the charges, and she would then follow up. Instead, what she did is she grabbed the sheriff's department to issue these charges for her, which tells you that she was in a hurry to file them, and that she was going to do it as quickly as possible, and that does not inspire any confidence that her focus was upon having a complete record of evidence before her before making these decisions.
I'm going to push back because Marilyn Mosby is not with us. I mean, the sense of urgency is certainly something that is echoed in the community, and the sense of many citizens in Baltimore that grand juries are where charges against where allegations against police go to die. So your concern about not having a grand jury in this case doesn't seem to be echoed on the streets.
Well, that may be the perception on the streets, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that is an accurate perception. I'm not saying that had she used the grand jury, the charges would have gone to die. What I am saying is that by not using him, by not using that process, she has opened herself, and I think rightfully so, to a perception that she was determined to charge these officers, whatever the evidence. She will now be taking these cases to the grand jury because of the way she charged this case, but she at this point will be using them to rubber stamp what she has done, not really to flesh out the evidence.
I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Dan Rodericks here on Midday, and I'm speaking with Paige Kreuter, who spent 20 years in the State's Attorney's Office of Baltimore. She's former deputy State's Attorney for the city. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, give us a call. Call at 410-662-8780 or toll-free at 866-661-9309, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org.
I would like to respond to your comment that the statement of probable cause seems to indicate that there's evidence to charge these officers. I have read the statement of probable cause, and unfortunately, and this is one of the problems, I think, with probably having done this hastily, is that the statement of probable cause does not support the charge of second-degree murder at all. There are a lot of attorneys out there who have indicated that they feel most of these charges may likely get dismissed, that the statement of probable cause reads as a litany of a series of negligent acts that led to a tragedy. Negligence is not criminal unless it's grossly negligent, and even gross negligence, which is mentioned in the probable cause, is not the same thing as second-degree depraved heart murder. So,
I want to hear the rest of your thought, but I do want to ask you to tell us more about that charge, second-degree depraved heart murder.
That's right. That's actions in which you take, in which you ought to know that your actions could result in death. It is one of the most common examples given is if somebody goes out with a loaded gun on the 4th of July and starts shooting their gun all around and a bullet hits somebody. They didn't necessarily intend to kill the person who died, but their actions should have been obvious to them that as a result of their action, their affirmative action, that somebody was going to die. What the actual language in the probable cause used, and it clearly her office drafted this up, was that they were grossly negligent. That'll be interesting to prove that, have to prove that, because one of the things the prosecutor's office does not know right now is how he broke his neck and how, and she's going to have to prove that the officers knew that he had such an injury as that and failed to act. It's not like he was lying in a pool of blood. So she's got some proof issues, but that's my issue really is that on the face of it, I'm responding to your comment that the probable cause supports the charges. I would say, especially with respect to the most serious and the most sensational charge, it does not on its face.
And on that charge, am I right? I think I read someplace that second degree depraved heart murder charge does not require proof of intent.
No, that's correct. But you have to you have a high standard where your actions, as I said, you would have to have reasonable knowledge that your actions could lead to somebody's death. When you have officers who apparently were regularly checking on him, it's going to be difficult to indicate, to establish that they knew he was dying or thought he was going to die. It's a very high standard of proof with respect to what they had to know in order to justify second-degree murder. So the other thing that she has done, and I saw this alluded to by one of the defense attorneys, the two arresting officers, by her theory of the case, did not cause his death. It's like they're in it because had they not arrested him, he would not be dead. But she's not indicated in her statements that they caused Freddie Gray's death. She's charged them anyway. And it's a very novel theory. It is because she's charging them criminally for arresting Freddie Gray without probable cause. Right now, the remedy for that is a civil action, internal discipline, suing the police department. Criminal charges for that is novel, and it would be a profound difference in how the police are handled and a very chilling impact on the police department. I cannot believe that she really thought that through before bringing these charges.
We're almost out of time, and I would like to hear from Jerry in Baltimore, who's calling on this point. Jerry, can you give us your point quickly?
Yes. I just wanted to call and say that part of the conversations I've had with others in Baltimore regarding this very polarizing incident is that most of us, and I'm a black woman that lives in Baltimore, and I have a, a black teenage son. And, you know, I do feel heartened that the state's attorney, I don't feel like she had made a decision to press charges ahead of time, no matter the evidence. I think she was determined to ensure that once the coroner's report showed that there was homicide, to go ahead and proceed with charges and then let justice take its course. And so often, many of us feel like that is often not the route that's taken, and that the lives of our sons are not as valued as other lives in Baltimore. And I hate feeling that way, but that is a true and genuine feeling. And finally, someone said that, you know, if it happened, this young man died in police custody, somebody is accountable for that death. Had he not been arrested that day, it is not a novel theory that he would have been alive.
We're out of time. I'm sorry. I've misjudged the time because I'm not a pro in this job, but I appreciate your coming in. Paige Crowder, thank you. Paige Crowder is a former Baltimore City criminal prosecutor. That's Midday's First Hour. At 1, we'll hear from a gang violence interventionist about how gang members have responded to the protests in Baltimore. And we'll hear about the potential political consequences of how last week's riots were handled. Lunch today provided by Rosina Gourmet. Since 1999, Rosina Gourmet has served homemade, locally sourced ingredients for their sandwiches, soups, salads, vegetarian items. Rosina Gourmet is located in Canton, downtown Baltimore, and Harbor East. Catering available by visiting rosinagourmet.com.